KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Magdaleno Rosavilla is the first director of Seattle's Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. It's a job he took in September. Before that, he was the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Leno, as he's called, is the son of immigrant parents, one of a dozen kids. He went to work at age 11 in Colorado's onion fields. Later, he became an organizer and a spokesman for Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers Union and the first executive director of the Cesar Chavez Foundation. Leno has been the Peace Corps country director for four nations, a leader at Amnesty International. He's co-founded organizations to abolish the death penalty and taught nonviolence to youth gang members. And now he brings his expertise and passion to helping out and serving Seattle's immigrant and refugee communities. Thank you so much for coming by.
Wow, that sounded great. I wish I had lived all of that.
Says you did.
I know it's great fiction sometimes. It seems like it anyway.
Is it true that you were one of 12 kids?
I was one of 12 kids. I was the sixth. I had nine sisters and all of them smarter than I am.
Wow. What was it like to grow up with so many kids in your family?
It was very interesting. That's where I first learned about gang warfare, is having 12 kids. And we were probably the poorest family in our city in Las Animas, Colorado. And it was great because you have a lot of mentors, both when you're a child, and still my older sisters are my mentors, and I listen to them and learn from them. But it really is, and I never understood how parents who have so many kids, how they make it economically. My parents had to work two, three jobs. Sometimes my mother, as a nurse's aide, worked 24-hour shifts just so that we could eat. And you never really appreciate that till you get out and start doing it. And the only reason I went to work at age 11 because my family needed another wage earner.
Wow.
And that's why I went. It wasn't that I wanted to work. I'm probably the laziest Mexican you've ever seen. But you have to, when you have to eat, yeah, you go to work.
Leno, I understand that you were really interested in theater as a kid, but you were discouraged from doing that. Is that right?
Well, I was discouraged because in my hometown, they told me that there were no parts written for Mexicans. My accent was too great. And then when I went to the University of Colorado, I started acting and got the leads in major main stage plays. So it's amazing. You know, once you branch out, theater was, when Shakespeare wrote, he wrote for everybody. When Lorca wrote, he wrote for everybody. You don't have to be of an ethnicity to perform a good work of art.
What was your favorite part?
My favorite part was the insect comedy, where I played an alcoholic who wastes his whole life. And then just when he's ready to die, it's he remembers that, you know, what you have to live for. And I think that happens to so many of us, that, you know, that Martin Luther King would talk about, that it doesn't matter how long you live, but what you did when you're alive. And, you know, a lot of people live a long life and never do anything, never take any risk. So you got to take the chance. And that's what I've been given the opportunity with my life, is to take chances.
Now, I understand you were able to use that theater training to try to reach gang members. You were trying to turn to a nonviolent route in Los Angeles. How did theater come into that?
Well, one of the persons that I ran into is Ann Cusack, who is this younger sister of John Cusack. Ann is also an actress, and she had a program called Arts Expand, taking the theater and arts into the correctional schools. And so I met Ann, and we became fast friends. And then she took her program, and we used it with gang members to break into, you know, it's sort of like a it's an icebreaker, and you get into the art, and you get people expressing their feelings, you do physical actions, and before you know it, we had gang members talking about their true feelings, writing poems about it, performing pieces about them. All people have artists, and especially street kids, no matter where they are, no matter what their ethnicity, have a lot to give, and it's just finding that key to open that door.
That might be surprising to some people who might think, oh, gang members, they're going to be tough guys. They're not going to want to do acting.
No, but, you know, once, you know, because I worked in El Salvador with the toughest gangs, and once you get them out of their neighborhood, out of that environment, they're youth who have not had any youth in them. And, you know, so a lot of the, you know, I would find once we get them, the further away we get them away from their neighborhood, the more they act their age and act like, and a lot of kids don't have things. So I'll give you the story about one guy, El Chuco. So Chuco, I said, he's a gang guy, 26 years old in El Salvador. And he said, I was going to L.A. and, you know, everybody wants headscarves or rap music. And I said, Chuco, what do you want? He says, I want a white teddy bear. And I go, what do you want? You're a grown man. What do you want with a teddy bear? And he says, I've never had one. And so when I came back and I started looking at it, a lot of these kids never had any toys, never had any opportunity. They didn't have their childhood. And then for one of my birthdays, Booby, who has since been killed, he came up to me and he had one of those Hallmark teddy bears in a little basket. And he said, you know, I want to give this to you for your birthday. And he had just read me a poem. And I said, well, what's up, homie? What's up with the teddy bear? And he goes, oh, you know, Magdaleno. I go, no, I don't know. Tell me. He says, Magdaleno, you know, just take the teddy bear. And so I said, okay, give me the teddy bear. And I said, Booby, you're trying to tell me that you love me. He goes, Simon Loco, which means yes. And I go, I love you too, my brother. But, you know, it's so hard to express it. But I think what, you know, for all our youth, whether they're in gangs and not in gangs, who just go to school, everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to have that expression. And, you know, in my work with organizing farm workers and gangs and now with immigrants and refugees, you know, one of the things that I found, and I've been in Seattle since about 2003, is that every day that I go out into the streets of Seattle and I run into immigrants and refugees out in this community, you know, we have people that are 10 times as smart as me, better organizer, doing better work. I just happen to be the lucky one that the mayor chose for this position. But there are so many qualified people out there that I listen to every day.
What got you to Seattle in the first place?
I was a Peace Corps director in Micronesia, and I saw right after 9/11 the wrong direction that I thought the government took. They put Immigration and Naturalization Service under Homeland Security and FEMA. And we saw the failure that FEMA had in New Orleans. It did much better in New York. And I knew that we were going to have a lot of discrimination. I started seeing those. So I applied for a job in a number of cities. Seattle was the one that hired me. I wanted to be part of a struggle to defend immigrants and refugees because my feelings were correct that what we were going to have is a real misguided justice system. And, you know, we started going after sects. We started going after Muslims. We started going after Latinos. And it hasn't stopped, and we've got to stop it. And so I came because I wanted to be part. It was a historic struggle and still is until we get comprehensive immigration reform that it also includes refugees.
You have been in this office for less than a year now. What is your goal with the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs? What's sort of at the top of your to-do list?
My goal is, and I think for Sahar Fateh, who works with me in my office, a great attorney and good human rights activist, ours is to do number one, the best we can for immigrants and refugees and the citizens of Seattle. Number one is a lot of the people don't know all of the programs that the city is doing and has for people. So, you know, one of them is like utilities support for, you know, emergencies and for people that are really in poverty. So we want to get those programs. We want to tell people about them, how they access them, how they use them. The mayor wants us, you know, when we came in and we asked him, what do you want us to do? And he said, basically, I want you to create miracles. So I went out and I tried walking in water for a few days. I tried to cure a couple of people of their ailments and couldn't do it. So now we're back to the practical work. What can we do that opens doors for economically the aspirations economically of immigrants and refugees? How do we connect them with the rest of the city? Because really what we want to do is we want to make Seattle the best community in this country where you connect immigrants and refugees with the regular community. They're treated equally. We open the doors to the city and to employment. And you know what people have to find out? Because if you look at the immigrants and the refugees that come to this country, in a lot of ways, they're more law-abiding than most of the people that are here. And they really cherish the freedoms. They really cherish the ability to exist. And so what we're doing in the city is trying to make it a safer community. So one of the programs that the mayor started, and we're participating actively in it, is a program called Safe Communities, where we've gone around and heard from people in the communities. We've organized public meetings, about 100, 150 in each meeting. Half of those have been immigrants and refugees, where people come in and say, what are the issues that I have with the police? What kind of police help do we want? And now, in our second stage, we're going around having meetings with the police, people from the mayor's office, 5, 10, 15 people in their homes, in their community centers. Because one of the things that happens, you know, for a lot of refugees and immigrants, when they left home, the last people they ever wanted to talk to was the police. Because mm-hmm. once you talk to the police, you could end up in prison and disappear.
What's it like for you to be working for the city? I mean, you were an advocate when you were working with the Northwest Immigration Rights Project. You were an organizer when you were working for Cesar Chavez. You're kind of in the system now.
Yeah, they say I'm working for the man. And it's kind of nice in this respect, is that I have good communication with the mayor. I knew the mayor before I even applied for this job. And I respected what he was doing as a voice for immigrants and refugees. So when city council created this position and the mayor took it on and he started screening, you know, he went through a big consultation about what kind of person they should get and you know, what the office should look like. And you know, when they asked me what they should get, it, I said, you should get an older Mexican-American that's overweight and losing his hair. And people laughed, and here I am. I think because, you know, there is a frustration for those of us who come from the community that get into government. But you know what I found? And you never eliminate all of those frustrations. Even when you work at a radio station, you know, not every day is smooth. Not every decision is embraced.
Oh, at KUOW it is. But yeah, I understand what you mean.
I'm talking about the rest of the industry. But, you know, even in my own family, not everybody agrees with me. But I think what I'm given is the opportunity to be a voice for the voiceless. And we take that as a very sacred opportunity and an opportunity for us to do the right thing. And so no matter where you are, you have to work. Even when I worked for the Cesar Chavez Union, when I worked for against the death penalty with Sister Helen Prejean, it wasn't always smooth. Decisions always didn't come your way, but you knew you were a part of change. And that's what I'm excited about, because the city's ready for change, and we're ready to show them how to do it.
It's an interesting context to be doing work with immigrants and refugees, because although we have, I think, the most diverse zip code in the country, it's also a largely white city. It's one of the whitest cities in America. Does that at all influence your work?
Well, of course it does, but you have to understand that Seattle is one of the best red cities in the world, or the city, or in the U.S., and because we have, and you know, what we have here is we don't have a perfect society in Seattle. There is none. But what we do is we have a tremendous amount of goodwill. You know, I've worked with enough donors, foundations, workers, immigrants, refugees, that we have the goodwill, in spite of the divergence between Anglo-Saxon and the people of color, we have the goodwill and the opportunity. Doesn't mean that it's going to come easy. Doesn't mean that we don't have to work for it. But we have to be clear about our objectives. And I think that we want to make this society not race-based, not separate anybody from the rest of the community. But what we want to do is say we have to value everybody, wherever they are. Just look at the elections, what we did, what Seattle voted for. I mean, it shows that we're on the right side of history. Now we have some other steps that we have to do. We're not perfect. We may never get there. But I think that we can do a lot of pieces of that puzzle that make us better, makes our city better.
Magdaleno Rosavilla is talking to me about his new job as the head of Seattle's Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. And you say that and it sounds kind of singular, immigrant and refugees, like it's all one thing. But we're in a city like Seattle with so much diversity, we're talking about people who are immigrants and refugees who are very different one to the other. You're talking about dealing with a really diverse group, aren't you?
Right, because you have refugees that have been here 18, 19 years. You have new coming refugees. You have families that I ran into a gentleman who had one son born in the Middle East, one son born here, and he says they're like day and night, two different children. You have people that come from very urban areas, from more torn areas. You have we're getting a lot of Bhutanese that we knew nothing about. And we're learning about, we're still getting Burmese. You know, we're going to get a lot of people who, just like our soldiers, are going to come shell-shocked from Iraq and Afghanistan. We have to be ready for that. So they're all different.
Yeah.
You can't, and immigrants, you know, even from Latin America, Mexico, wherever they're coming from, they're all different. And so you just can't say, here's one medicine for all the immigrants. And that's why when people talk about change, it's called comprehensive immigration reform, because it's got to include everybody.
And do people in the immigrant and refugee community self-identify as immigrants and refugees? Or do they go, no, I'm Bhutanese. No, I'm from Mexico. No, I'm from here. Or do they have any solidarity amongst them with these identities?
Well, it depends on the community. But I think all of them consider themselves either immigrants or refugees.
Yeah.
But you begin where you are, you know, like I'm a Chicano, Mexican-American. Then I begin and I become part of the greater Latin American society. And I think what the beautiful part of America should be is that we should be part of larger communities, but we should never lose our self-identity. And, you know, just like if you go into the ID district, you have so many great Asian API communities that are there working together, have their businesses. And because of their self-identity, they're able to bring more to the table to the larger community.
You were actively working in California on a proposition that would have replaced the death penalty with life in prison without parole. It was defeated by voters in California last week. Why do you think that happened?
Well, you know, we were really surprised that we came that close. We were only 3 or 4 points difference between that. And that's the greatest step that's ever been done. I went on an 8-day tour with Sister Helen Prejean, who wrote the book Dead Man Walking. Took a week off from work to go talk to people, primarily Catholics and Latinos, about the death penalty. I think that, you know, that people are getting ready, just as they are on marijuana, just as we are on equal marriage, that we know that laws that we've created, punishments that we created, don't work. So I think even though they lost, if they would have had more money, more time, you know, because this was raised, this is like a poor people's campaign. We had a few major donors, mm-hmm. but a lot of people gave it their sweat equity to work on this, just like they did on these campaigns here in Washington, is we know that when people give it their time, that we can change history. You know, Cesar Chavez told us, you know, in the end, we're going to win. When we may not win today, but in the end, we're going to win. And that's the way we're going to abolish the kind of punishments that are harsh, that are unreasonable, just like the marijuana incarceration that picks up so many Latinos and blacks. We know that we are better as a country, and we've got to come back. We've had so much fear put into us about immigrants, about refugees, about youth, about people of color. We got to come back and be sensible about what we do.
Yeah, we're just about out of time, but do you foresee on the horizon an effort to abolish the death penalty in Washington State, and would you be part of that?
Well, I can't be representing the city because we don't take positions on that. But I know that there's a great effort that's being done by committees and people that are working to abolish the death penalty in this state. And I think that all of us, in whatever way we can, limited or aggressively, have to support issues that connect human rights. And I think that, you know, where you have people of goodwill, and I think because, as I say, Washington is a city of possibilities, and I'm excited to be working for the city of Seattle. I'm excited to be a resident, and I'm excited by the challenges. It's not going to be easy, but we're going to do it.
Magdaleno Rosavilla, the first director of Seattle's Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs, thank you so much for stopping by. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.